on air, online, on Twitter.
Jennifer Campbell is always on.
Unfiltered, opinionated, and ready to speak her mind at a moment's notice.
This is the Jennifer Campbell Show on 570 News and Rogers TV, Cable 20.
Now, special guest host, Jeff Pickle.
No, there ain't nothing that I gotta prove. You think your words will make me black and blue, but I think I'm pretty.
Welcome to the Jennifer Campbell Show. Glad to have you along here if you're listening in on 570 News and, of course, our friends watching on Rogers Cable Channel 20. Jeff Pickle here, happy to be with you this morning, filling in for Jennifer Campbell, who is still in England, turning her awesome assignment of covering the royal wedding and has then parlayed that into a vacation there. So enjoying some well-deserved time off is Jennifer Campbell, still touring, I'm assuming, the English countryside. She said she really wanted to see Stonehenge. So maybe that's on today's plans for Jennifer, visiting Stonehenge there. I've never been. I thought, you know, of all the things to do, that was one of the more unique things that Jennifer wanted to do. But I guess it is an attraction that brings people from around the world. So there you go. Stonehenge. Got a great show for you lined up today. A little bit later on, around 9:30, we're going to talk about some of the unique ways that the city of Kitchener is trying to slow down your driving. This nice, beautiful weather we have. The unfortunate thing with it is that the nice weather also brings speeders, fast drivers, people driving too quickly, and there's some unique ways the city of Kitchener is going about trying to slow you down. After that, right off to finish off the show, people have been sharing on Twitter a number of feelings of the things you should have or how your finances should look by the age of 35. There was a report out saying you should have double your annual salary saved up by the time you're 35, and a number of people responding saying that might be a little unrealistic for many people to have that by the ripe age of 35. So we're going to get to all that, but off the top, we are just over 2 weeks away from what has been one of the most interesting provincial campaigns ever in our province. Over the last week, we've seen the polls shift, and what was once considered a done deal is no longer such a certainty. We have seen the two leading parties also come under attack. Doug Ford and the PCs are facing tough questions about their candidate selection process and some possible misuse of confidential information, and the NDP have admitted they made a mistake in the costing of their platform, a $1.4 billion mistake, and they are being called out for that error and being certainly labeled by the Liberals as unfit to govern. So a lot of things happening, the polls shifting, everything moving. We're in a really active point of the campaign, just 2 weeks away. To help me chat a little bit more about what's going on in the election, I'm excited to be joined by Barry Kay, professor of political science at Wilfrid Laurier University. Barry, thanks so much for joining me.
Good morning, Jeff.
So let's talk about that. The big development over the last week or so has been that surge by the NDP, shrinking that gap between them and the PCs, which was once seen to be very much as it's been written, somewhat of a done deal, but now it not so much so. Why is that?
Well, it looks like the NDP has become the default for the Conservatives. The Liberals have tanked. We have a seat projection that will be, I don't think it's on our website yet, but should be a little later this afternoon. We're just releasing it. But the fact is that in the last set of polls taken since that have been released since May the 12th, there's five of them with an aggregate sample of about 8,000 people. We now have a margin between the Conservatives and NDP of about 5 points. It's 38% Conservative, 33% NDP. The Liberals are down at 23%. The Conservatives, that puts the Conservatives by the, we have an algorithm that we use, we've used it over time, and it's worked pretty well in the past. The algorithm we've used suggests that the Conservatives are now at about 69 seats. We had them up in the 80 range just a couple of weeks ago. This is an interesting election. It's going to be, there is uncertainty as to whether or not the Conservatives can hold a majority, in part because the NDP has had the momentum, and that momentum has been sustaining. The next set of polls may make it a little bit closer. Now, where the NDP runs and where the NDP is successful usually isn't where the Conservatives are successful. The NDP tends to be picking up ridings that they're contesting with the Liberals, particularly in the north and industrialized cities, Hamilton, Windsor, so forth. But people are, even though they're unhappy with the Liberals, that seems to be a foregone conclusion. I don't see Kathleen Wynne coming back at this point. They'll hold some of their seats, but they're not going to be able to form a government, or at this point it doesn't even look like they're going to be able to finish second. But people aren't all that confident in Doug Ford either. At the moment, he's still slightly over the level for a majority. They would need 63 seats. They've got 69 by our configuration. That's plus or minus a few seats as well. We'll see at the debate that comes up. People are not happy with Wynn, but they're not all that confident in Ford either, and that has given the NDP a shot at a time when we think of the NDP usually as the perpetual bridesmaids, always coming in at third place. The one time that they won an election in 1990, it happened because both the Conservatives and Liberals in those days were viewed very negatively. That seems to be the circumstance now that's given put the NDP in the position to at least get close to office. I'm not suggesting that they're going to get the largest number of seats. That doesn't seem likely. But if they can hold the Conservatives short of 63 seats, rather, we're going to have a very interesting legislature where, in fact, there will be a minority government. I don't want to get too ahead of ourselves. We're not quite there yet. But I think on election night, that'll be the question that will be most interesting. Even if the Conservatives come first, are they going to hit the 63-seat majority or not?
And that's, I am interested in what's going on with the NDP and that surge we say that we're seeing. Now, is that surge coming? Do you think it's coming from what the NDP specifically are doing, or is it more of, as you spoke about, a kind of collapsing of the Liberals and what they're hearing from the PC? Is it more of a reflection of the party itself, or of what they're seeing being offered by the other two parties?
Well, again, the rejection of Kathleen Wynne has been signaled for a while, but I think many, not all, but many people are getting buyer's remorse with regard to Ford as well. They are not particularly confident. I frankly think that Christine Elliott would have done much better and would be well ahead if, in fact, she had been chosen the leader, not Ford. The NDP has a core vote. But normally, the swing voters do not tend to take the NDP that seriously in most ridings. So in answer to your question, I think it's more a rejection of the Liberals and now the Conservatives as well that's caused the NDP to be taken more seriously as an option by a greater number of Ontario voters.
And so are NDP strategists trying to chip away, bring some voters over from that PC, or is it more just about trying to continue to steal away those Liberal votes?
Well, I think the likelihood is not all people vote ideologically. Not all people even understand the ideological implications. It's more likely that people who are left of center are going to be attracted to the NDP than people who are voting conservative. Another factor is that that Andrea Horvath actually has just come across as fairly likable. She has run an upbeat, positive campaign. She was smiling during that first debate in Toronto when the other two leaders were attacking each other. And I think that has sort of provided a comfort level for people that are unhappy with the Liberals, and clearly there's lots of those. The Liberals have been in for 15 years. Frankly, they've been in long enough. It is time for a change, and I think most Ontarians understand that. This was certainly a golden opportunity for the Conservatives to be able to form a government, a majority government, and they're still there, but frankly, they're getting to the point where they're hanging on by their fingernails, because we had them up in the over 80 seats just a few weeks ago, and now, in fact, they're under 70 seats. And if they drift, if they lose very many more, because a number of the seats we're positioning with them, I mentioned 69 at the moment, but a number of those are very close. particularly the most competitive areas in the province where we have a map with the LizPop website. I don't think people will find it immediately, but a little later this afternoon, it should be available. The seats that are too close to call, they'll be gray in color. We've got blue for the Conservatives, dark blue if it's a safer seat, pale blue if it's a more marginal seat, red for the Liberals, and sort of a golden yellow color for the NDP. But the gray seats are where this election is going to determine whether it's a majority. A lot in Mississauga, a lot in the GTA. Mississauga, some in Brampton, some in Markham, some in Scarborough, some in the area around Pickering and Ajax, around Toronto. A disproportionate number of marginal close seats there. The NDP isn't all that competitive in many of those ridings. So for people who are unhappy with Ford, and don't want to see a Liberal majority, might want to think as to whether or not they should look at the voting history of their riding to see whether or not it's the Liberals or the NDP. The NDP is strong in a number of areas, especially in the north. If you look at the map, you'll see that the northern Ontario is almost solidly golden color for the NDP. And that there are other pockets around the province, and they're picking up a few seats in places that they haven't done well before. I think we've got them ahead in Sarnia. We've got them very competitive in Brantford now. Also a little bit in Scarborough, but that indeed the notion of strategic voting may very well enter into the calculus if people want to stop a Conservative majority. I think the ballot question effectively will be whether the Conservatives are going to get a majority or not get a majority. The Liberals are not going to form the government. It looks very unlikely that the NDP is going to have enough strength and to move into those areas that have traditionally been Conservative. The NDP does not do all that well in the parts of the GTA that are still undeclared, in places like Mississauga and Oakville and so forth. But that's certainly going to be the question that voters should think about.
And have we seen any shift at all in what you're seeing locally as far as, you know, the seat projections? I know you said that numbers might not be quite available just yet, but I know we were looking at majority blue, I think, in Waterloo, at least from the last projection. You had that staying with the NDP, but we're looking at the majority blue and kind of that light blue, I suppose, meaning slightly less certain. But is that still kind of what you think we're looking at locally?
There's a mix. Catherine Fife is in stronger shape. I think we had her gray not too long ago, and then it shifted to light, to sort of light yellow, the last one. I think she's moving into the gold area. Look, but I think there's probably not a new Democrat incumbent in the province who's really in serious trouble at the moment. They're going to be gaining seats, not losing seats. The other seats vary. Conestoga certainly is that's the most solidly Conservative riding. I'm sure they'll have no trouble holding that riding. They won it last time when the party did poorly province-wide. And the Conservatives are ahead, frankly, other than Waterloo, in probably every other riding in the area, including Kitchener Center and Kitchener South and Cambridge. And some of those, I think, are pale blue. Maybe many of them are pale blue now. And indeed, those are more competitive if, in fact, there is somewhat of a shift. I should mention that by our calculations, gray means that we have calculated that the party that's ahead is a margin of less than 5%. The pale color, blue, red, or yellow, is between 5 and 10%. If it's over 10%, we have a more solid color. With regard to Conestoga, that's solidly blue. With regard to Waterloo, it's solidly gold or orange. Actually, we want color separation, so it's more of a gold color, I think, on our map. The other seats tend to be pale blue. There may be an exception to that. So at the moment, if I was being asked, I would suggest the Conservatives will win everything in the immediate KW area except for Waterloo.
And I notice, Guelph is kind of an interesting case, too, because of the Green. I'm assuming that the Green Party throws an extra kind of wrinkle in there, seeing as they're, you know, the Green Party leader is running in the riding of Guelph. Do you have any indication of how much, you know, what the, I guess, chances are maybe of, I know the Greens were really hopeful of, you know, electing their first MPP in Guelph. What's the situation in Guelph? It's currently showing up as gray, so
yeah,
very much
under... stay gray. Sandals, of course, Liz Sandals is retired. She had a very big lead, though, which in fact is the reason why that's a riding that would normally go Liberal or Conservative, but we do not have the Conservatives with sufficient numbers to be in first place. I wouldn't put a lot of money on the Greens, but you're right. That's the one seat in the province. If the Greens have a shot, it would be in that riding. The Greens actually outpointed the NDP last time. But there is this NDP surge. I would be surprised if the NDP doesn't do better than the Greens there. But in terms of who's going to win it, I would still put that one as too close to call, unlike any of the ridings in the KW area at the moment.
Now, Barry, thanks a lot for that analysis of what's going on here. And I'd be remiss not to ask you, I know how much of your attention is focused on Ontario, but I know you always have an eye heading south of the border. And I know that there's some, their kind of midterms are a little bit further off. But I wonder if you could just chat with me a little briefly about what are some of the trends, we're seeing south of the border. I know for people who pay attention to American politics, what was looking like a Democratic wave rolling over has been kind of stopped a little bit short. Can I get you maybe just for a little bit on what some of the major trends you're seeing down there just south of the border?
Well, we're 6 months out from the election. The election won't be till November, and lots of things can change between now and then. Certain polls that ask people whether they would vote for the Democrats or Republicans congressionally are tightening up somewhat. The Democrats are ahead. But one of the factors that influences me in thinking about that is the fact that intensity is much stronger for Democrats, and that indeed normally the out party, that is the non-presidential party, now the Democrats, tend to do much better in these midterm elections anyway. I would still bet on the Democrats taking control of the House, not the Senate perhaps, because so many of the seats up this time are Democratic seats. They really don't have much room to make gains. There are a few seats. Arizona and Nevada, possibly Tennessee, are seats they could gain, but there's a bunch of seats they're vulnerable in places like North Dakota, West Virginia, Indiana, Missouri. I think I wouldn't bet on the Democrats taking the Senate. I would bet on them taking the House. And what that means is probably impeachment proceedings, maybe leading to impeachment. I don't want to get too far ahead of myself on that either. But for people who are interested in the fate of Donald Trump, and again, he's newsworthy every day, frankly, every hour, it seems, that the likelihood that Donald Trump will be removed from office, barring a huge landslide that we don't anticipate now, if the Republicans really don't just lose the House, but get clobbered in the House and lose the Senate, it is possible Republican elected officials may come to realize that, in fact, he is a liability and should be removed. But Republicans are torn because of the fact that Trump is popular with their base but unpopular with the general public. And in order to get reelected, they have to win the primaries with their base and then go face the general electorate. And many of them are in fairly safe districts. So a prediction there would be that the Democrats will take the House, not the Senate, impeachment proceedings will begin. But they would actually have to get not just all, even if every Democrat in the Senate voted for, if we came to the point of a trial, and I'm not saying that's a certainty, but if we got to the point of a trial, if every Democrat in the Senate voted to convict Trump and remove him from office, you would still need a third of the Republicans doing so as well. And that, I think, is very unlikely. So I think we're going to be having to live with Donald Trump through the remainder of his term until 20 through 2020.
Yeah, well, it's not a bad way of putting it. And no, it certainly is, as you said, a constant newsworthy issues going on down there. So thank you for that brief analysis of what's happening south of the border. Once again, Barry, thanks a lot for taking the time to join me this morning.
Happy to talk to you.
Okay, once again, that is Barry Kay, professor of political science at Wilfrid Laurier University, and one of the brains behind Liz Pop, which does an annual seat projection for any of the elections coming up, one that has proven in the past to be quite adept at selecting, or I guess forecasting, which way each seat is going to go in the province, and then also in national elections. We'll maybe tweet out that exactly what that is, and you can take a look for yourself where some of these contested seats may go. We're going to have to take a quick break, but we're going to continue with election talk right after this.
When extreme weather hits, count on the 570 Extreme Weather Center, exclusively on 570 News.
And we are back with the Jennifer Campbell Show. Thanks so much for tuning in, and thanks so much for Dr. Barry Kay, professor of political science at Wilfrid Laurier University. I'm sure Barry remembers, and I remind him once in a while, that he was in fact my professor when I was at Wilfrid Laurier University studying political science. It was my American politics professor. I think on three separate occasions I had classes with Dr. K. And that's why I was quite confident I could ask him about American political issues, even though the majority of his time is focused right now in our province, that he would be well adapted to talk about what's going on south of the border. The man is an incredible wealth of knowledge about American politics, but certainly some very interesting things happening here north of the border right now as far as the election goes. I think we might have time. If you were talking about how you think this election will go, has anyone changed their mind? Has your vote changed in the past 2 weeks since the campaign trail has been going? Give us a call in, 519-570-2545. We do have time for maybe one call if we're quick. Other than that, we might have to circle around back to the end. Certainly from what Barry Kay has told us is that the PC is holding on a lot to what they have, the base holding firm. It's the NDP gaining ground, mostly from the disappearing Liberal vote, which isn't too surprising, as Mr. Kay mentioned there, moving over from, you know, all the way from PCs to the NDP party is quite an ideological shift. But then again, sometimes, you know, people don't really know what the shift is. Anyways, we do have a call in. Okay, we have about 10 seconds for you, Alex, here. What's your thoughts on the conversation with Dr. K?
Well, I think the Conservatives have the best shot to win the election in Ontario. That's fine. But I was a little taken aback by his take on the American political scene. I couldn't disagree with more than what he said, that all the head Democrats are running away from impeachment talk. They say it all the time now. The generic polls show their support crumbling. All the economic indicators in the states are, the economy is roaring. The people are happy. They're happy with their jobs. Their wages are going up. So for a political science professor to ignore all of that because of his hatred towards the president, I think does you and your listeners a disservice.
Okay, yeah, no, absolutely. Alex, thanks for the call. We are at a time here, but again, maybe we can always do some American political talk. I know that will fire him up, and we can maybe circle back. I'm here all week, so we got time to do that. We got to take a quick break for the news. We'll be back right after this.
With all the technology at our disposal, it's a shame that most of it is wasted on nonsense. Download the 570 News app at 570news.com and stay informed.
All right, welcome back to the Jennifer Campbell Show. We almost got into a spirited debate there, and we might have a chance to do that a little bit later on, depending how things go. But absolutely, some good political discussion, both domestic and abroad, right here in the province of Ontario. No better time. 2 weeks before an election, this is when things are moving and shaking. This is when things are happening. This is when it's the best time to pay attention, to play along. Even if you're not that committed one way or another, it's just good. It's just good spectator, a good spectator sport to follow along when the gloves come off 2 weeks before an election set to happen. I'm just going to retweet this out right now. So LISPOP is, I'll have to get the official what that acronym means, the Laurier Institute for the Study of Public Opinion and Policy. LISPOP. It's obviously out of Laurier. They do their seat projections here, and they just tweeted out what they have here. So seat projection as of May 22nd. That's today. They have the PC party with 69 seats, the Ontario NDP with 39, and the Ontario Liberals with 16. So as we mentioned, that 69 seat projection puts them six over the necessary to form a majority. That's 63. That's the magic number. If we get if there's 63 and above, it's a majority. If it's anything below that, we're looking at a minority government, and however they hope to form that or plan to do that, that will be could be a certainly very interesting turn of events there. think I'll retweet that again. You can follow along with me at Pickle Press. That's P-I-C-K-E-L. So kind of like the food, just the E-L on the end instead of L-E, Press, P-R-E-S-S. Follow along to the show, to the morning reporting. An occasional tweet that I think's funny that you likely won't. And, of course, follow along right here at 570 News and the Jennifer Campbell Show. So I was thinking about getting this a little later on, a little closer to the end of the show, but maybe we'll jump into this now. One of the things that caught my eye over the weekend, and certainly if you follow along with Twitter, you may have noticed this as well, as I have clearly exited out of this, the article that was gonna help me here, but here we are. So people have a lot of feelings about how your finances should look when you're 35 years old. There was an article with some retirement experts in MarketWatch, a piece that suggested people should have twice their annual salary by the age of 35. And the internet wasted no time in sounding off on this financial advice via social media. I know. So we have some people sounding off here. What should you have? So 35, for me, that's a number that's approaching quickly. So I'm on the before end of this, but certainly many people listening will be all around that age. Where were you at when you were 35 as far as your financial standings with looking for your retirement? I'm at about the $0 mark, so I am substantially behind double my salary. There's some tweets here that say, by the time you're 35, you should have debt twice your salary. Another one satirically saying, by 42, you should be able to lift thrice your own weight. By 16, you should have written your first screenplay. And by 8, you should have a self-portrait hanging in the Philadelphia Museum of Art. That's a good one. I like this one quite a bit here. Another tweet saying, by age 35, you should run into friends and say, we should hang out soon, twice a week. You will never hang out. You will scream this at each other until one of you dies. How are we doing here, Polly? Okay, we're good. So we're going to skip back to that maybe a little bit later on. We can hear your financial advice about what you think we should have as far as your financial planning by the time you're the age of 35, which is a scary number, I'm assuming, for a lot of people who probably haven't saved very much by the age of 35. But onward to the topic plan to chat about at this particular time of the morning. Of the many great things that come with this warmer weather, that although it is gray, cloudy, and rainy, the warmer weather is coming. It's already been here for a little bit, and there's more on its way. One unfortunate byproduct is an increase in speeders on our roads. This year, the city of Kitchener has a three-pronged approach to help curb bad habits. And one of those tactics you may have already seen while driving through Kitchener, that's middle-of-the-road traffic signs. These bright yellow but waist-high signs are meant to be a more visual reminder to slow down and pay attention to your surroundings. Here to chat with me today about the ways that cities can help slow down motorists, Barry Cronkite is the manager of transportation with the city of Kitchener. Barry, thanks for joining me.
No problem. Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about these road signs, middle of the road signs that I've seen pop up here when I was driving through a few Kitchener neighborhoods over the weekend. What's the kind of idea behind these signs, and how are they used to slow down traffic?
So the idea behind these signs, as you said, they pop up in the middle of the road. So what they do is they create sort of that visual disruption. And in doing so, it makes the lane that you're in feel narrower than it actually is and causes you to slow down as you're going around it.
So that's just kind of something that pops out a little bit more. And you know, if it's if you're driving on kind of an unbroken stretch of road, you may... mind may wander and speed may increase, and this kind of helps check that a little bit?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, as drivers, even in our own neighborhoods, we drive what we're comfortable at. So if there's nothing that disrupts that comfort level, then it's very easy to speed. And we find that throughout the entire city. So that, in a nutshell, is why we've targeted so many streets that we have with these signs. We have four of these signs in each ward, essentially. And so far, it seems to be working really well.
That's good to hear. And is this the first year that the city has decided to try this out?
Yes, this is the first year of what we call our seasonal traffic calming. So it's a program that we rolled out late last year, and it's a combination of these signs that we're talking about, these flexible signs, and the LED display sign that you would see on the side of the road as well, that flashes your speed at you. Again, something that, at least in the short term, catches your eye and makes you aware of how fast you're going.
Is that the kind of general thought that once people aren't meaning to speed, especially through these more residential neighborhoods, it's just something that, you know, without that reminder, as you said, anyone who sees one of those signs that tells you your speed, you know, typically, you know, most of us certainly slow down. Is that, you know, we just need more kind of visual reminders?
That's exactly it. I mean, in terms of what we hear here in our office, speeding is by far the most common concern that we hear throughout the city. And we all, for all intents and purposes, don't mean to speed. But again, because you're comfortable and you're going, you tend to go a little bit faster. So once we bring in those visual cues, more so than just the traditional speed limit sign that you would see, because it's kind of off the beaten path, really. It's on the side of the road. You don't really notice it right away. Once you put something that's right in your vision, then that's what leads to that slowdown.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny that you mentioned that the most common thing that the city hears of all the, issues faced by a city as far as, taxes and land use and parks and libraries and all that. I've heard it before. Many people said the most common thing that a city hears about is still traffic, something so basic, so much that every city, it's an issue in every city. Can you give us a sense of how much volume as far as, whether it's complaints or comments about traffic that you guys see?
Well, what I'll do is highlight our traffic calming program and traffic calming priority list for you. So we have 170 streets, roughly, that are currently on a traffic calming list. So 170 requests for traffic calming throughout the city. So that kind of paints a picture of why we're doing some of these lower cost seasonal measures, because we do 3 full-scale reviews a year. So to be able to handle the sheer volume of requests that we have to address some of those, we needed to get creative. And this has definitely been a great tool for us.
Yeah. So there's obviously the lower costs methods, like the signs. If it is, if the situation persists, is that when, more costly avenues have to be looked at?
So our formal traffic calming that you would see throughout the city, the speed humps and curb narrowings and those sort of things, definitely come at a much greater cost. So to give you some sense, a speed hump is roughly 15 times more than one of these signs. So again, that's why we only do 3 reviews a year. The cost is, comparison is apples and oranges.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And we talked about, you saw like the idea that these things certainly, can be successful and hopefully are. Have you heard any complaints? I seems to be that no matter what's done at any juncture, there will be complaints as well. Have you heard any complaints thus far about, the potential of hitting signs or people unhappy with the placement of them?
Sure. So generally speaking, what we're hearing about the signs is fairly positive. And we've had, since they've started popping up, we've had probably, upwards of 20 to 30 additional requests for these signs. We have had a couple of concerns come our way. And generally speaking, when we have those concerns, it's about the placement of the sign and people parking in relation to that sign. And we've went out of our way to make sure that that shouldn't happen. But there have been rare instances where people are still parking near those signs, which then makes it much more difficult to get around it. So as you can appreciate, if you park anywhere in the immediate vicinity of that sign, you can no longer just go around a parked car. You have to go out around a parked car and around that sign, which forces you completely into the oncoming lane of traffic. So as I said, we've been very careful in terms of where we've located these signs, but if people do tend to park in that area, then there have been two locations where we've removed the sign since relocated to an area where we wouldn't expect anyone to park.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, no, and that's great advice too. Keep mindful of those signs when driving and when parking. Barry, thanks a lot for taking the time to join me to talk about this. Let's hope it works. Let's keep it safe on those streets, keep it slow, and a few extra visual reminders are always good to keep instilling that in us as we make our way around through the summer.
Great. Thanks, Jeff.
Okay, thanks again. That is Barry Cronkite. He's the interim manager of transportation with the city of Kitchener. And accidentally, we booked two Barrys on this show. Two Barrys in one day. Barry K, Barry Cronkite, both B-A-R-R-Ys. If we could hear from Barry Verbanovic, of course, he's a B-E-R-R-Y, then, you know, three Barrys on one show. That would be some type of record, I have to assume, that I can go down forever in the annals of radio history as the Barry Show. If you're out there listening and named Barry, by all means, call in. This is the All Barry Show, the All Barry Power Hour. I'll leave it at that with the Barrys. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with more of the Jennifer Campbell Show right after this.
Baseball is too slow, they say.
The bringer of rain.
Try telling that to Josh Donaldson.
Here's the first pitch.
He's got less than a half a second to react to a pitch. Don't miss a single moment of Toronto Blue Jays baseball.
And that ball is gone!
On 570 News.
Unbelievable.
We are back with the Jennifer Campbell Show. Thanks so much for the two Barrys who joined us on the program.
I did that on purpose, by the way.
I didn't realize that at all until it actually came to it. I know who we have, but I didn't put it together that both Barrys, and I'm looking at this being like, oh yeah.
I just said, you know, it's Tuesday after a long weekend. Let's not confuse people. Have two Barrys on.
Let's get two Barrys on. Let's do it. And the call's still out. Barry Verbanovic can give us a call anytime just to complete the trifecta.
And a different version of how to spell Barry with Barry Verbanovic's name.
The lesser seen B-E double R-R-Y.
Yeah, and not B-A.
Not B-A. Okay, cool. We'll leave it at that. Barry can call in, let us know, say hi. But other than that, the Barry portion of the show is over. So I was talking about this, kind of yammering on a little bit before the second Barry called us in there about this. I was following along on Twitter, as I do most weekends, because I'm kind of addicted. And I kept seeing these tweets about things you should have by the age of 35 and things you should have in your life, you know, to know you're adulting well by the time you're 35. And this all stemmed from an article that said you should have saved twice, double your annual income by the time you're 35 as part of your retirement savings. And understandably so, much of the internet found this to be a little bit unrealistic. Never mind the fact that people under the age of 35 fall into the category of generational divide as millennials, who are well known to have not been able to save much money.
Well, because the cost of living is going through the roof these days.
I'm not disagreeing. You know? I wanted to read out a couple. The best one I think I saw was that that one I read just before the break. By the age of 35, you should run into friends and say, we should hang out soon twice a week. And you will never hang out. You will scream this at each other until one of you dies. And that's kind of exactly dead on correct. That's exactly what you do, is that you pass friends that you would like to see. But frankly, as years go by, you have less friends that you can see. And you have about three, I guess, by the time you're likely 35, and you see those three friends, and any other room in the schedule is booked up solid.
Yeah, I mean that's how it is for me right now.
Yeah,
I don't really do much though, to be honest with you. I work and stay at home, and that's basically it.
Like, this job is your life.
It is. I'm always trying to book the Mike Farwell show and the Jennifer Campbell show. That's what
absolutely.
I'm doing.
And sometimes, yeah. I like this one. By the age of 35, you should have approximately 10 times the existential dread you had when you graduated high school.
What does that mean?
Like, I guess just meaning kind of like the general life bearing down on you. What does this world mean? Who am I? What is the purpose of my life type of dread? 10 times as much as when you finished high school.
Make great radio. That's what I'm here for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know,
that's what I try and accomplish every day here.
I didn't have much dread finishing high school, and occasionally I get hit with one of those waves of like, is this what I was meant for? Is this it?
Is this why God put me on this earth?
Is this my life? When I'm sitting like on a long weekend on a Sunday afternoon and like eating Cheerios and like, you know, watching something on TV being like, is this really where I'm at in life right now? Am I achieving all that I can achieve?
Have you?
I think I'm leaving a little on the table. I think there's a little bit, you know what I mean? I think I might be, I think there's a very good possibility that that all my potential that maybe not be being actualized, but we're trying, you
hopefully
know?
The boss isn't listening to you say this.
No, I'm
you
not
know?
Saying I don't work hard at work. I'm saying outside of it. I mean,
I gotcha.
I think work's the easy part because it's laid out there in front of you and you know and you achieve well. But then it's those people among us who are able to, outside their working hours, are able to go and achieve much more and not just eat Cheerios, as I said, and you know, watch some mindless show or listen to some mindless banter or whatever it may be.
You know what I was trying to do yesterday besides getting sunburnt on my uncle's deck?
Okay. It's a good waste of, or a good use of time. Yeah.
Right? Finished booking the shows for today.
There
that's
you go.
What I did.
No, and see, that's good.
I put a little bit of work into my
James,
long
if
weekend,
you are actualizing, then that's good. I think, like, you know, I don't want him to hear it, but I feel like, you know, the work that Farwell is doing, that's a man who's self-actualizing. He is living. He's working hard at work, but then he's working exceptionally hard in a lot of facets outside of his work life.
Especially during the month of May.
Yeah. So let's not let him hear that. I don't want him to ever think that we're praising Mr. Farwell too much. But, you know, that's the type of person who's able to go home from work, to resist the urge to do nothing that is all so alluring and is able to do a little bit more.
Yeah.
Which I try to. I try tooth and nail to push myself to do more. And occasionally I'm able to do that. But that's why I find volunteering and like things that are set out for you. Like I coach. I do a lot of sports coaching.
Yeah.
And that's easy. Then it's like, okay, I have something. I know I'm showing up. I know they're going to show up. I know how to play this sport. And I'm just going to teach it to these young impressionable souls, and that's me making a difference, and that's me feeling like, okay, I'm achieving something else.
You're molding someone else's kid's brain.
Yes, exactly. And trying to mold it and help it in a way that, you know, is taking what you can give and then making improvements on that. making sure that you know that your mistakes that you've made and the shortcomings you have, and trying to help them go beyond those.
What's your first lesson that you usually teach these kids? Not to end up in the ER as much as you?
No, because that's often in sports, you know, if you end up in the ER, it's a sign that you're committing and you're doing something actually well. It's if you're not getting, slightly hurt enough, it's that maybe you're not putting enough effort in. I think the one thing I tell the kids that I never was good at doing until a little bit later in life is goal setting. and like telling him to like set a goal, set what you want to do, set some goals you can, set a goal for practice, set a goal for games, set goals and then try to achieve them. Where I think I went through a lot of parts of my earlier life kind of aimlessly, just, you know, working to no end. And then it was like, oh, this, if you set a goal and then work at it, that's a good rewarding experience. So I try to, that's one thing I never did that I try to teach.
That's not a bad,
that's a good thing.
Not a bad,
a good
lesson,
thing.
Yeah.
No, it's good. Once you start setting goals, it's a habit that you do over and over again.
When I played hockey, I was a goalie and a short goalie.
Yeah.
So it always seemed like my defensemen were setting the goal to headhunt during practice.
Right.
And that drove me crazy because, you know, you don't want to injure your goalie in practice for the next game. So I'd usually lose my mind on them when they did that. So that was my goal every practice, not to get hit in the head with a puck.
Right. So mine was a very broad speaking
yes.
life goal, and yours was very much it. But both of them, very good goals. James, we've ran ourselves right out of time here. We got the Mike Farwell Show coming up right after this. I'll be back with you tomorrow right here at 9 o'clock for the Jennifer Campbell Show. Thanks so much for listening.